Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 3:29 p.m. that is Central Time, and today is September 27th. Well, gold broke downwards today, so this is a new reaction low. It's closing below the psychological $1,900 level where it had bounced on several occasions over the last 3 months, and this is an extension of the 4 month decline that's been underway now. And this is there's a clear succession of lower rally highs, and that's going to have to get broken until we or at least before we have clear evidence that support is coming back in and we're in a demand dominated environment once more. So if we zoom out a little, we can then see I think that the next area of potential support is going to be somewhere around the lower side of the range. And that pretty much coincides with the region of the 1,000-day moving average right now. And we had a failed downside break at the end of 2022, and then it popped on the upside and got back above the $2,000 level and failed up there. And now it's coming back down again. I don't think that $1,600 is the lower side of the range. I think that was a failed downside break. I think it's more correct to say that it's somewhere more like 1725, but we'll have to see how far it goes down. And this is very much tied to the dollar. And what's going on in here today is quite interesting. We have continued dollar strength. We have very strong oil prices. The stock market went down in well, actually went up in early trading, down in the middle of the day, and then recovered somewhat. I think part of that was to do with President Biden's speech in support of artificial intelligence. I think perhaps a bigger reason was that Costco came through with earnings, and they were quite a bit better than expected. So the share reversed a 1.5% decline to finish up over 2% on the day. So it was a big outside day. But with, I think, the much bigger story today is the continued surge in yields. And the 10-year yield was up over 7 basis points. So as long as yields are rising at this pace, it's siphoning liquidity out of the system. And I think we continue to see resilience from the stock market. And probably the biggest reason for that is the continued willingness of the US government to run significant deficits. And then, of course, there is the potential that the US government is going to shut down again in early October. I don't really think that's going to be a major market catalyst, but for the simple reason that this is not the first time it has happened. And every time it happens, there's a lot of gamesmanship goes on, and ultimately they come to a deal. All the furloughed employees get their back pay, and everything goes back to normal again. But I think this is a good place to jump off and look at some additional chart. So when we think about what's going on here with the gold price, it has been going sideways for 3 years. And we're coming back from the upper side of that range. Now, ranges are explosions waiting to happen. And when it eventually breaks out, it's going to do so in a dynamic manner. And the surprise on the upside, and I do believe that the breakout will be on the upside, is going to be very emphatic. But in order to get there, we need two missing ingredients to fall into place. Well, the first one's the dollar. And the dollar index is really surging higher. And it's up on consecutive days, and the pace of the advance is accelerating. So in an environment where stock markets are weak and the bond market is selling off, then the dollar rallying is reflective of deleveraging and people raising cash. And they're putting that cash into money market funds, and money market fund assets are approaching 6 trillion now, and they're putting it into short-dated treasuries. And that's helping to suppress the yield at the short end of the curve, even while we have a real clear acceleration in the pace with which the dollar is rising and yields are appreciating. The short end of the curve is very quiet, and that is despite the fact that there's a clear risk that interest rates are going to rise again, if not in October, then potentially in December. And I think the major decision point on that is going to occur on Friday. And it really is going to come down to what happens with the core services ex housing. When we think about the kinds of things that can be influenced by interest rates, well, they've already moderated. And certainly we've had a moderation in some of the agricultural commodities and some of the other commodities, but not in energy prices. And energy is a major component in the raw CPI, which is, of course, why they look at the core rating. And then to take housing out of the equation is another important one because housing prices have been accelerating higher over the last couple of years. What I think is especially interesting is if we look at the performance of the S&P 500 over the course of the last year. We've had a good size rebound from the low in October. And if we simply look at year-to-date performance, there are really only two shares of more than doubled. And those are Nvidia and Meta. And Tesla is up about 95%. But then if we look at the last 3 months, we have a very different picture. So the best performers over the last 3 months, and at least the nine best performers over the last 3 months, are all energy companies. And energy is, and I guess we should probably refer to it as traditional energy or fossil fuel energy, because Albemarle is among the 10 worst performers, and that is one of the biggest providers of lithium. But the clear potential here is that we're going to see additional upside in oil prices. And there are a couple of different reasons for that. Well, I think the most acute of those is you can't empty the strategic reserve twice. And that means that there is less available supply to easily come to market. Then you have lots of independent oil and gas drillers and producers that are complaining heavily about the burden of regulations, the uncertainty of the regulatory environment, the inability to source the kinds of materials they require for drilling programs, and then the rising costs on top of that. And when you're faced with rising costs and you are faced with an inability to get the materials you require, well, you're not, that's going to be rather difficult to increase supply at the best of times. But then on top of that, when you're faced with an uncertain regulatory environment where it feels like everyone's out to get you, why on earth would anybody take that kind of risk? So we're not going to see the same kind of supply response right away, and prices are probably going to have to go up a bit in order to really encourage capital back into the sector. And that's one of the primary factors that is contributing to this continued uptrend in oil prices. Now, it's not like they have to go out and find new oil. There's plenty of oil around. And particularly, there's plenty of oil offshore. And there really hasn't been any exploration offshore or any development offshore for more than a decade because they didn't have to. There was a clear pattern of increasing supply coming from the Permian Basin and onshore. So there's no need to go off and drill offshore and pay the premium for that when you could do it onshore. You need to see prices sustainably above the $80 band before you're going to really start to encourage a lot more supply into the market from the offshore sector. There will be additional demand for the oil services sector. So that is continuing to grind higher. There's been a clear succession of higher reaction lows for over 4 years, or well, I guess almost 4 years. And now it is right in the region of the recovery peaks. We've seen also that several of the large energy companies are popping on the upside. And then going back to the best performers in the USA over the course of the last 3 months, then a lot of the refiners are in that list as well. And I think Marathon is a clear example there where the trend higher is beginning to accelerate. And it has been a really impressive advance over the la well, since the lows back in 2020. Then we also have some of the other better performers, where they're really only in the process of completing base formations. And APA is bouncing now from the region of the 200-day moving average. It has first step above the base characteristics. It's been finding support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average over the last year, and it has very clearly broken the downtrend. Now, one thing that I think is particularly important to remember is that we saw activity like this in 2008, where we had a very strong rally by commodities. Back then, it was fertilizers, iron ore producers, and energy. And they posted some absolutely incredibly swift accelerations on the upside. And there is the potential that we're going to see something similar on this occasion. The longer that oil prices continue higher for, then the greater the potential is that money is going to be funneled into the energy sector because of uncertain or disappointing returns in other parts of the market. And I think that is most particularly true of the semiconductors. Micron just came through with their earnings around the close, and they're anticipating a loss in the next quarter. So guidance really wasn't anything inspiring, and the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index is right in the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, we definitely saw today that the S&P 500 paused in the region of the simple moving average. And I think there's a lot of people will be looking at that 4,200 level and thinking that that is a reasonable level to initiate a long position because we have a short-term oversold condition. And it's the upper side of the underlying range. However, I think that we have to pay attention to the fact that 10-year yields are going up, and they're going up in a hurry. So we've had another advance of 7 basis points. The yield is up to 4.6% right now. This is a very clear and sustained so far breakout from what has been a range over the course of a year. And this is contributing to the yield curve spread starting to push back up again. So this is now trending higher. And we have to give some due consideration to the speed with which it contracted. And that was reflective of the pace with which interest rates were going up. But as long as the yield curve spread is contracting, it's still it's a countdown until the long and variable lag of monetary policy catches up with the market. It's usually at the end of that process when the yield curve starts to trend back up again. And it is trending back up again. So then when we think about what's going on, well, when we have such a strong move in the dollar, then this is representative of deleveraging. I think it's particularly relevant also to look at the Nasdaq, and that it pulled back by 37% in 2022 and then rebounded by over 50%. And then contrast that with the performance in 2000, which was, I guess, the last time that we had a similar move. So we first had a drawdown of 39% and a rebound of 43%. So this rebound has been even more powerful. But that was the last time that we had such incredibly strong dominance of the market by a very small number of shares. And the predominance of the Fang Man and Tesla companies, well, that is not entirely unprecedented, but the last time we saw anything like it was the 1990s. So I do pay quite a lot of attention to this ratio of those 8 companies relative to the total market cap, and it is rolling over. So there is obviously the potential that it is going to break downwards from here. And the continued pace of tightening, well, there's a couple of different points. And I think it is worth considering what happens during a period of quantitative tightening, because the Treasury has to fund its deficit. And the Federal Reserve is no longer buying the bonds, and foreign investors aren't buying them either. So they rely on domestic investors to buy those bonds. And what it is essentially doing is siphoning reserves out of the banking sector. And its banks are, and insurance companies are funding those deficits when the Federal Reserve isn't buying the bonds. So the banking sector is still trending downwards. Now, it was in mildly positive territory by the time it closed in here today, but this is not a happy looking chart. And then we can think about the regional banks as well, that they encountered resistance and they continue to decline here. Now, we had a rescue of that sector back in March, and all of the deposits were insured, and that remains the case. So they're pulling back now, not so much because of the risk of losing depositors, although that is obviously a risk, but rather that their businesses are heavily impacted both by the withdrawal of liquidity as well as the negative or the inverted yield curve. Now, this is another example of what was kind of similar today with 2007. We've had a good sized move higher in the oil price. We're seeing banks underperforming and liquidity conditions are tightening. So this is holding out the prospect of a re-rating of the upside potential for the equity market. And there was, I think, a very interesting question lodged by a subscriber via Substack this morning, asking about, well, is this environment different than what we've seen in the past? Because classically, when you look at the how the yield curve is inverted, what you generally have is that yields on the long end peak before the short end, but we didn't have the only other time that did not occur was in the period around 1981 through the beginning of 82. Back then, we had the 3-month yield popping on the upside first and then continuing to hit new highs, but then starting to hit a new low when the 10-year was hitting a new high. So that was a clear divergence. And then, of course, we had the inversion, and then it was very deeply inverted for a long time. So I think that was the only example where we've had the 3-year moving in advance of the 10-year. But of course, that was also a time when we had banks that were under a great deal of duress, surging oil prices because oil prices went up significantly in the early 1980s. And we can see that with the historic chart. And we can simply zoom in then on the 1980s period. But the big picture here is that if we have surging oil prices, where from the low in late 1978, the price went from about $13 up to $38. By towards the end of 1981. So that was also siphoning liquidity out of the system. Now, this is obviously not as problematic in the USA today as it was then because energy intensity has decreased and the USA is an exporter. But of course, it is a problem for everywhere else. And when you have oil prices and when you have oil prices and the dollar going up at the same time, then that creates an energy cost problem for any kind of importing market. So at the oil price right now in US dollars is 96 for Brent. If we then change that into pounds, where the pound is depreciating against an environment where oil is rising, well, then we're going to have a very different situation. So prices are now approaching £80, and the pace of the advance is picking up, and it is on the cusp of breaking out above the peak put in 2012. Then in euro terms, it's very similar. And then it's a good thing that Japan is certainly looking at restarting some of its nuclear reactors, or more of its nuclear reactors, because the price of oil in yen is going to be starting to become problematic pretty soon. The devaluation of the yen is at a rather critical area, and it's testing the 150 level. So this is obviously an important level where there is the potential that the Bank of Japan will intervene. We're not. I don't think we're probably there yet. I don't think the Bank of Japan is really in any mood to support the currency, but it is very oversold, and the depreciation of the yen, well, then that is certainly supportive of carry trades, and then also the depreciation of the Swiss franc. Usually, in times of duress, one would anticipate that the franc would be appreciating, but that has been a very impressive rebound by the dollar over the last 7 or 8 weeks, and it is now breaking back above the 200-day moving average and breaking the sequence of lower rally highs. So, we're not seeing the same kind of demand for the Swiss franc at present that we would normally see during a period of uncertainty. Then, when we think about the wider global economy, well, there's obviously the potential that a recession in the USA will have a knock-on effect in many other countries. Then, a recession in China would have an even bigger knock-on effect because it hasn't had a recession. And today, at least, the property sector was a little bit steadier. And the Hang Seng was in positive territory, but not in an especially dynamic manner. And then we can see here that the CSI 300 was able to scratch out an advance, but unable to hold it. There is still a great deal of uncertainty around what exactly the Chinese government is going to do to try and support growth, and really how much they can do. So we're still in a tight liquidity environment where banks are underperforming and the energy sector is starting to perform. And the US market is holding on, but I think there is clear potential for additional downside. And I think that the market is pretty much holding its breath ahead of the inflation figures on Friday. Now, when we think about some of those other emerging markets, those that would benefit from trouble in China, so India is certainly one of those, and it put in an upside Q reversal today. Now, it's a small one, and it will certainly need upside follow-through in order to confirm a signal like that, but at least it's continuing to hold the sequence of higher reaction lows, and then the trend higher remains in place. The Indian government is talking about selling several billion dollars worth of 50-year bonds, and that is aimed exclusively at serving the domestic insurance and banking sectors. And the fact that the domestic financial sector has matured sufficiently to create demand for insurance products is really quite a sign of the rise of the middle class. And India, with hundreds of millions of people entering the middle class, that's going to create demand for new consumer services. And I think that is something that is going to only be improved upon as the economy industrializes and it becomes more of an exporting powerhouse. I think then the uncomfortable for many discussion about what's happening with the vast number of people coming over the border, the southern border in the USA, is that many of them are working age men and not so much families any longer. And the USA is going to need a workforce if they're going to compete with China in a globally competitive environment. I think one of the the easy the easy way of dealing with those asylum seekers would be to sign them up for national service or selective service, and that they would by necessity have to serve in the armed forces if called upon during a period of stress. Then see how many of them want to stay in the country. But certainly there is the potential that a lot of this migration that's going on right now, some of it obviously is going to put a burden on social services. There is no question of that. But the migration of young, capable people into an economy is something that can improve productivity. That is the primary argument for thinking that a country like India, with hundreds of millions of people under the age of 25, has the potential to become a manufacturing powerhouse. Importing millions of young, able-bodied people into a country is also a potential way of enhancing productivity and reducing some of the inflationary pressures. Quite whether it's politically feasible to talk about it like that's another question entirely, but that does appear to be what the reality is. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.